Why are you wearing sunglasses?
So look, I'm a big proponent of taking feedback, and I heard after last week's episode that me going at a kid while sitting in business class, it may be highlights that I am the bourgeoisie, and so these are my hater blockers because I don't need to see none of y'all.
I'm Scott Wayne,
and I'm I'm rich.
I'm the proletariat, and this is Envoy Recorded Radio. Three.
We're home. We are home, but it feels different because we've rearranged everything as we're wont to do, like once, twice a quarter. It feels good in here.
Yeah, if you hear noise in the background, we are reconfiguring studios because for our therapy, about once a quarter, Ace and I uncable everything and recable everything as a sort of meditative connection exercise. We work through our differences.
It's been like 6 hours since we were here recabling things. And,
in the middle of the night.
Rinse and repeat.
Yeah, so we're in the studio. I'm around all week. Are you around all week?
I am around all week. I'm on the ground. It's unsettling.
It's great. Yeah. So while we're in town, let's switch to involuntary sponsor of the week, which is Richmond International Airport. So International Airport that doesn't fly anywhere internationally.
Doesn't it have like one international destination?
No, it doesn't. I think what that means is it flies occasionally to the West Coast.
Close enough.
The TSA team there were actually rated as one of the worst in America by surveys issued by the TSA. And I just want to say, you're actually the best. The TSA crew at Richmond Airport are fantastic. They're always really friendly, really efficient. And just to remind you, if you're listening, surveys are the worst way to get objective feedback around something, whether something's good or not, because the likelihood of people who are thrilled with TSA completing a survey for the federal government is ridiculously low, and the one or two people that are upset with the fact that you don't let them push in line or they won't take... Can we just pause for a minute? For any foreigner, the reminders at every airport that you can't carry your handgun in the passenger section of the plane emblazoned everywhere. When you're dealing with those people,
I love surveys. Big survey guy.
I
got survey feedback back recently, and I got like a 2 and a 3, which was fascinating. It was great.
You never get 2s and 3s.
No,
you always. Was it out of 5?
It was out of 5. Yeah.
You always get fours and fives.
It was wild. It was a new thing. But again, back to me taking my sunglasses off and putting my real glasses on. I think I just need to be kept humble. And that's
so does
happening.
That... Listen, I'm happy to lean into the theme of you being an elitist snob, but does... If you were consistently getting 4s and 5s with audiences across the world, and then you get a group where you get a couple of 2s and 3s on the rating, but you felt you delivered in the same... And the majority is still 4s and 5s.
Yeah.
I mean... Lots of people would be like, oh, Ace, we need to talk about your performance. But doesn't that say more about the group than it says?
Like we always need to talk about my performance, but not because of that feedback.
A data analyst would look at that and say, actually,
these are outliers.
The changing variable is the membership of the group. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. So I would suggest, based upon that feedback, you don't change your delivery style.
Yeah, well.
All right, let's come on to the zeitgeist.
Can we start with Paul Graham? Because that guy's a dickhead.
I don't know who he is.
Yeah, he's an investor. Was early in Y Combinator, like one of the big tech accelerators. You've got some ranting, I think, later about the tech sector. So I'm gonna preempt it. Paul Graham tweeted a couple days ago. It was sometime this week. Someone sent me a cold email proposing a novel project. Then I noticed it used the word quote delve unquote. And then he goes on a Twitter rant about how Delve is just, it's an indicator that somebody has used AI to write a paper or an email, and that using big words doesn't make you sound smart. It's just a prompt that you have used AI to write the thing rather than putting your own words to it. And there has been, as one would expect, some fascinating conversation around Paul Graham. Talk about being an elitist snob. I can't even compete in that company. But the conversation that has stood out to me, and particularly as I'm wearing my articulate hat, delve is a word that I happen to use regularly and don't use AI to write any prompts. It's a word that one might use if they are decently educated. And I think about the out groups that we talk about, or marginalized groups that are told to speak in a certain manner, often an anglicized one, in order to sound intelligent, to be taken seriously. And now the counter narrative here is that actually, if you use big words, you are over-indexing on trying to sound intelligent and just use normal language. And it's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't positioning from a multimillionaire, almost billionaire, maybe. I haven't looked in Paul Graham's net worth in quite some time. But I understand the underlying comment, and I think it comes from a place of wild, outsized privilege to be able to say, don't use Delve. It makes you sound like you've used AI, rather than you might have had to over-index on the language you use to be taken seriously in most of the rooms that you've shown up in. So, that's my Paul Graham's a dickhead rant. Thank you.
There's another explanation for the use of that word. Mm. They might just have been British.
You use Delve quite often.
Well, this is a gripe of all Brits that live in the United States, is the narrowness of the choice of vocabulary. There is not a shortage of English words, but culturally we choose in the United States to use fewer words than we would in the UK. Delve and dig mean very different things. Like that is a very specific word, and you will hear me talk about it. I do this with the team. It's like, can we have more specificity? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the thing that you are talking about and the outcome that you want? And yeah, this is just ridiculous. Yeah. No, use words that mean the things that you mean, and if they happen to have come from AI, they happen to have come from AI. And I'm like, yeah. On your articulate cap,
yeah.
So just for those of you who are not watching the live stream that we're not putting out right now, so you're wearing a blue baseball cap.
Yeah, I'm a blue one on
written
today.
Across the front, articulate. Yeah. And you get a lot of second looks from people with that. In a way that I don't think I would get second looks.
No. So I think we've talked about it a little bit before, but yeah, the idea that I have had this conversation like three times this week because I've had the hat. I had the red one on the other day and I'm wearing the blue now. But yeah, the idea that black men who, people of color, black or otherwise, who speak well are often called articulate, and the expectation is that we shouldn't be articulate, hence the Paul Graham rant. Mm-hmm. The expectation is that we might not be articulate or that our education was lesser than, so on and so forth. And so, the Paul Graham thing and the provenance of a word. There's one of my words, apparently. Perry's smiling at me. Provenance. Let's keep running with that one. The provenance of one's vocabulary is a function of upbringing sometimes and education sometimes. And sometimes it's a function of reading and being well-traveled and seeing the world. And so the expectation that some groups shouldn't be as articulate as others, and then the comment that is supposed to be a compliment that one is articulate, I find to be fascinating and belittling and at times offensive. And so I wear a hat that says, fuck you, that's why. But it just says articulate instead.
Yeah. Do you know what British people say when they're studying something at university? You don't say I'm studying philosophy. You don't say I'm studying physics. I'm reading. Physics. I'm reading philosophy. You read something at university. What are you reading at university?
Yeah.
It's a little posh, but it's still sort of widely used. So I've got a thought of another cap for you.
Oh God.
Is you can have two. One that says yanking chains, and the other could say chaining yanks. just let that go. Just see what the commentary is. I wore my Noted t-shirt for a board meeting.
Oh, how was that?
Early this week in New York. And I said, look, there will be members of the group who want to, feel that making their point and reiterating their point will add to their point. It won't. Once you've made your point, all board members are equal. Once you've made your point, make it once. And if you make it again, you'll hear me use this phrase. And I sort of pulled back my jacket. I just said noted. Well, anyway, I was in LaGuardia heading back that afternoon. And this deep New Yorker like sidles up next to me. This older guy says, "You're missing something." And I thought I dropped something. I forgot I was wearing the t-shirt. He went, "Dooley." You need to add a dooley to that noted. Just drive it home.
Dooley part's maybe my favorite. It is. I love it. Hey, we need, at some point, we need to talk about our types while facilitating, because we both have, we won't go into the duly noted is for your type, for sure. And the articulate is for my type, is actually how that works.
Yeah. Hey, so as we're talking about sort of upsides and downsides, can we talk about doom loops a little bit? There was an article this week in the Wall Street Journal about St. Louis being trapped in a doom loop. Mm-hmm. So a doom loop is where people start pulling out of being in a place, crime increases because buildings are vacant, and then nobody will be in the place because crime rates are so high. And it was an article about St. Louis in that San Francisco is sort of hovering on the edge. And you might have read about companies like Salesforce investing vast sums in this city to try to keep the city alive. And you could say that's out of self-interest because Salesforce have a raft of real estate in San Francisco itself. But we were in St. Louis a few months ago and we saw this. Do you remember walking through the streets? Because you'd worked there and you're like, oh, this place is great and that place is great. And I was looking there and saying, this just feels sketchy and empty. And of course, you were living through your memories. But doom loop, I think that's quite interesting. This tipping point of if you want your towns and cities to exist, you have to spend money in them and you have to be there. It's like civil protest. You can't protest through a tweet. You have to go protest outside of the legislature or the parliament. If we want to believe in cities, and you've got to go spend cash, like get offline, get in there, spend the money. Otherwise, you reach this tipping point of a downward spiral, and it is very, very hard to recover it.
It is, and the natural inclination is we are losing people, therefore we have to up taxes to keep up with the city, and then it becomes the barrier to living in the city. So St. Louis runs into this. You have folks who will live just over the city line in the counties. Or I think they're called counties, and somebody will correct me on that. It's because the taxes in the city are astronomical to keep up, because they have to be, because there are fewer people paying them. It's messy. And so that loop is real. We saw that through the 50s and 60s as folks moved out to the suburbs and cities declined. And now you've got the young hip kids me moving back into cities, buying things. But it continues to perpetuate this. Well, it's really expensive to live here, so only a certain type of person, but the schools haven't kept up, so we don't invest in the schools, so people move back out when they have kids because that's the place the schools are good, or you send to private. It's a messy
So I'm going to upset everybody who works for or runs a nonprofit or a charity to say that I would encourage people to stop giving money to charity and instead go spend money in person. So what I'm saying by this, look, I'd love you to give money to charity as well. What I'd actually like you to do is to buy less shit, but the odds of that happening are pretty low. Instead of that money you save, so let's say you're saving 15% by buying from Amazon and having it shipped to your house. That is a different purchase from going to your neighborhood shop, interacting with a human being, learning something, and spending money in your community. Even if it's owned by a large corporation, you are still employing that person in that community, in that space. You are still more likely to buy a cup of coffee or pay for parking or any of those things. And I'd far rather you spent that 15% in there, because a lot of these charities and nonprofits are trying to solve the very problems that are created by not investing in local communities. So just don't, like, cut it off at its source. It's much more efficient to get it into its source. Maybe dial back the philanthropy and spend local. You get very few tax. In the US, it used to be that you got rafts of tax benefits for philanthropy. You don't anymore.
No.
Which, again, isn't really full philanthropy, is it, if you're doing it for tax write-offs or part of it for tax write-offs? But maybe donate a little bit less. Just spend it locally. And that doesn't mean that, like, look, even if you, if you're like, I'm really busy, I need to get stuff shipped to my house, great, order from the local place and have it delivered with a local service. It's not that hard to do.
So interestingly enough, I'll push on the like local service thing ever so slightly. I think you and I shared an article. I have no idea where it is. But there was this conversation about the UK and like family-owned shops shutting down because they're paying a raft in fees to delivery. And it's just delivery drivers have queued up in front of their spaces, or they're the only ones in line and nobody's actually in the stores. And like the argument was, yeah, it's convenient to get things brought to you, food from restaurants locally, etc. But if we want to continue to have nice things, we may have to leave our front door and go to those places, because the tip revenue and the people sitting in and the vibrant communities that get built are what keep the doors open of these places.
Completely.
And just ordering Uber Eats or Grubhub, etc., while very convenient, and I use it on occasion, we are doing a disservice to the places that we want to be able to order from because they can't survive.
I don't remember the article. I think it was in the FT. It might have been the Times.
We'll see if we can track it down.
The London Times, the Real Times.
It was good.
But it was, wasn't it something like, go and eat a hot meal instead of getting mild, warm slop delivered
like
on a moped.
The food is better in the back of somebody's
Google
scooter.
That. You'll find the article. Find slop and moped, and the article will pop up for you. Hey, we're doing a short episode this week, so I don't want to miss this opportunity to just celebrate the German, the German sort of janitorial operations staff at one of the leading modern art galleries in, I think it was in Munich. I want to say it was in Munich. In Munich, who was an aspiring artist and hung their own art.
I didn't see that. That's,
so
that's
they're like
brilliant.
They're part of the evening janitorial staff, and they hung their own piece in the gallery. And apparently this is the second time it's happened this year in another city in Germany. Somebody else did the same thing. He got fired. And I don't know. I think he...
And banned from the gallery.
Yeah, poor teen guy. Nailer. Whereas he is banned from the place he worked. I don't know. I feel like he deserves an award. But I just like that.
Look, he hung his art alongside the likes of Picasso, Max Ernst, and Dali. And, you know, well, I love it.
All right. I'm not going to rant about the solar eclipse. That's on LinkedIn. Go find it.
Fair enough. We'll leave it. Should we go to Tank Radio?
So this week, so I went to see David Sedaris the other night. Elizabeth got
How was that?
It was all right. Okay. I feel like David Sedaris is David Sedaris. So you've seen it. Whatever.
You've seen it.
But
once,
he did say,
it, yeah.
He said, so tonight there is a state dinner for the Prime Minister of Japan. He said, a few weeks ago, I was invited to that dinner and I'm here in Richmond talking to you lot. He seemed to have genuine pain. I don't blame him. Anyway, there was a state dinner the other night at the White House for the Prime Minister of Japan. And the day after was an announcement of yet another alliance between Japan, the U.S., and the Philippines to start joint patrols in the South China Sea. Joint patrols. This is Chinese Coast Guard boats and sometimes boats that are the Chinese military but presented as civilian boats who are ramming Filipino boats and not Japanese boats yet that are in the contested waters around the South China Sea that legally and technically are recognized by many nations to be international waters. So there's this sort of matrix of treaties being signed and alliances in Asia that the US is leading to try to essentially constrain China. China's argument is that America is trying to constrain China. That may look very true. And then this AUKUS agreement, which is an agreement between Australia, the UK, and the United States to share nuclear technology, initially around submarines, and it's now expanding into other areas. And there's talk that Japan will join that alliance. So my feeling last year that we were going to create a new NATO for the Pacific seems to be moving forward under this AUKUS banner. I would expect the South Koreans to be part of it soon. But again, everything just heating up and heating up and heating up in multiple parts of the world.
Yeah. Tis the season. It's messy.
And then a couple of other things in international affairs.
Caribbean cocaine.
Yeah, so coke through the Caribbean, not cocaine in the Caribbean. here's the kick in the ass from colonialism is these islands in the Caribbean that are still technically the possessions of colonial powers, UK, France, etc. Now, France has always taken the view that if you are a colony of France, you are part of France. Mm-hmm. You are you're part of the French sovereign boundaries. Well, what that means is that you can get coke into some of these tiny French islands, and they're technically in France. So once they are on the island, they don't get custom checks going into the European Union, into France. And once they're in the European Union, they're
take it wherever.
So, but this isn't. So these Caribbean islands are being used not just for drugs from South America, but just anywhere in the world. Coming into these islands. So, anyway, so if you're snorting coke in the continent of Europe right now, there's a good chance it came through a Caribbean French island. And then jumping to the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan is taking its 25th bailout by the International Monetary Fund. And just a reminder that our news sources really don't reflect. I'm always blown away by how much coverage of the UK there is in the US, given how there are much larger countries with larger ramifications. Pakistan has 242 million people. That's so far behind the United States. It is run, while it claims to be a democracy, it is fundamentally run by the military and the intelligence community. It is nuclear armed. And we pay very little attention to this country that deserves lots of attention. And by we, I mean the general public or the bourgeoisie, as in your case. We just don't. And it's just a reminder to sort of try to read stuff that is not the headline grabbing things. Go a little deeper into those publications that you read, whatever you read, because there's a lot going on in the world. So I don't know, my first flight by myself was on Pakistan International Airlines.
Really?
Yeah. So the first place I changed planes was a kid growing up in Teesside was Islamabad. It was quite
I can only imagine.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, love it.
Food was great.
Tools. For tools. Hey, so how am I supposed to say I'm reading? That does that mean studying?
Yeah.
I'm reading. Are you familiar
reading
with
economics at Cambridge? Let's just be clear, I didn't.
I'm reading Immunity to Change Framework from Harvard, not at Harvard, to be very clear.
Yes, that's
from Harvard. So this is an interesting, I think, addition in the way that we think about behavior and observable behaviors as a way to start shifting how teams operate. I was pointed to this framework, and I'm really digging it. I've been delving in a bit to this framework.
Digging.
Sorry.
See, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Digging in. You're just using a shot. Delving. You're saying it. Delving. Yeah, you're like using exploring. Your hat. You're pulling it away. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like I'm going full Christopher Columbus on this. You know, pretending I discovered it. So Lisa Lasko Leahy and Robert Keegan, professors at Harvard, or one's a professor, one's a lecturer, because people care. But the idea here is for teams that get to for people, humans, could be a collection of humans or could be individuals, but for folks who get to a place where they want to change a thing, the Immunity to Change framework basically calls out that sometimes there are deep-seated, subconscious, or unconscious things that are precluding our ability to change, even if we have high motivation, desire, and have expressed that. And so the research that they've done at the Graduate School of Education is around this immunity to change rather than desire for change. And what it basically says is every time we get to a place where we say, hey, I want to take X behavior and shift it to Y behavior, and then we get to a place where we haven't shifted to Y behavior, we have to ask why. One would expect. But what they say is it's the unconscious thing that we have to dig on to say, okay, I've articulated I want to change my behavior, but I'm not being successful, which means there's some... there's some counterbalance to that change that I have to uncover so I can move forward. So an example I saw was about volunteering, for instance. Hey, I want to volunteer. I've said I wanted to volunteer more. I'm not volunteering more. Why is that? I've said I want to do it. I have all the tools at my disposal to do it. And if you dig a little bit, you might get to, well, my boss has to sign off on my ability to go volunteer. And my unconscious, call it bias, but aversion to making that ask is I don't believe that my boss believes in volunteering the way I do. So if I go volunteer, my boss is going to think I'm slacking off at work, and therefore it will jeopardize my employment. And so I'm actually not going to volunteer even though I want to. My colleagues or coworkers might think that I'm slacking off because I'm off volunteering and I'm not carrying my share of the weight for our team. Therefore, I'm not going to volunteer. So it's not just to say I want this behavior, but it is to fully explore the hurdles or the barriers that might preclude us acting on the thing. And that like deep-seated piece is our immunity to change, even though we want to.
So it's presuming that we have an immunity to change, and then you're trying to uncover what that solution is.
Yeah, because otherwise we'd just change. Right, like we were with a team that was really concerned. They're like, we have all the behaviors we want, and we've gotten close to this before, but we're not going to do it, or it's going to be really hard to do it. How do we make sure it sticks? And what I'm seeing or thinking about is that there's just a missing layer. You've now gotten to a good place. You want to do these things. What is the actual cultural underpinnings that is precluding the behavior change?
So you treat it like a detective's investigation.
Exactly.
What is it? And then you're taking away those variables.
Yep. Yep. And then you test your hypotheses. You play it out, like, and this is like pulled from the therapy world as well, but you would play it out. You'd maybe even role play, like, okay, well, if I want to do this thing and I go to my boss and I say, hey, I want to volunteer, what is my boss going to say? Well, volunteering's bullshit and you shouldn't do that and you don't clearly care about your job. That's what's happening in the back of our mind, whether it actually happens in person. And we can go test that hypothesis. Hey, boss, I'm thinking about volunteering. Can I find some space to do that? How do you think about it? And we find out if they don't believe in volunteering or if they're like, heck yeah, go. And that releases the thing because it's no longer this, I believe this is going to happen. It's actually, I've proven out it will or won't. We test hypotheses.
This is like the can but won't of that performance quadrant exactly. thing that we love.
Yeah.
It's like you investigate why is the won't and can you solve for it?
Mm-hmm. Huh. And if it's real in the first place, right? Yeah.
Well, Ace, that sounds very sort of wholesome and constructive and inclusive, very different from your like yelling at children on trains. So let's rebalance things and go yell at clouds.
Oh, here we are. What do you got to yell about? I'm good.
All right, so I'm just going to say this out loud. Like, just our absolute failure to be able to hold two thoughts in our head at the same time drives me insane. It is perfectly acceptable.
Death of nuance and manslaughter of context.
Yes, here we are. For those who are interested, we're working on a book called the. We haven't quite decided which way this goes around, but the murder of nuance and the manslaughter of context, or some combination of those. We're looking at the IP right now. So it is perfectly possible to have these two thoughts at the same time, that Israel is grossly and disproportionately overreacting to the situation in Gaza, and that Hamas hides within the civilian population.
Yes.
It is possible to say both of those things and recognize that one doesn't have to wholly pick a side in these, like, it's not a case where everybody is wholly wrong and the other people are wholly right. It just isn't. It never is. Anyway, that. And then.
But I think that like desire
that we've got a list,
got
a list to yell at, so we're gonna crack on.
All right.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say it's that we create this false binary. It's one or the other, and you have to choose. And like, I understand what we say the choice is, but I don't think we believe it that way. And so we should be able to hold both of those things.
And it's lazy. And it's also not, and on the other hand. It's not that I hate that phrase of, well, there's this, and then on the other hand, don't. No, it's not on the other hand. It's on the same hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are simultaneously things that are happening that can be both be true, and that's how life is. That's how life is.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. My next rant is, oh my God, tech people on planes and hotels. They just talk fucking gobbledygook. Like, it is just, I was sat at the airport the other day, and there were two tech people at the table next to me talking. If you wrote down what they said, and then you put it in Google Translate and said, translate this to Italian. Or, more importantly, translate this to English. The whole thing would collapse. Because it's just these words that don't mean anything. And it reminded me right at the beginning of my career, I was lucky enough. I had a scholarship from Barclays, the big global bank, through university. And
never heard of them.
I was, I don't know why I explained that. Yeah. So I was hired by Barclays immediately after university. I was put on their leadership development program, and the training, I was a terrible banker. I didn't last very long at all. I ended up with the Foreign Office, but the training was amazing. And actually the alumni from this group is still really remarkable, and some of us really stay in touch. But we were sent on this training. I remember it was Cambridge University, and it was a former chairman of the bank, and he handed out these like photocopied sheets. And he said, this is going to be the most powerful document you ever receive in your careers. And it was his guide to the terminology of banking. Mm-hmm. And he went through it and described what a derivative was. And mm-hmm. he was like, this is finance in what would have been the 1990s. He was like, we lock people out. Like, it is actually not that complicated. We use language to hold people out from entering this marketplace. And I want to make sure that you are armed with this. And tech is just it. Like, none of these words make sense. And you know all the words. I'm not even going to say them. But it's like, there was this particular conversation reference how this technology, it was a US-based consumer technology, would help the people of Gaza. And I was ready to lunge across the table and throw them. But back to your bourgeoisie comment, that it is this perception that if you just tell yourself that you're at the top of the intellectual game, it doesn't mean you are at the top of the intellectual game. Yeah. And they're built on business models where you buy market, you raise money, you buy market share, and you get the fuck out before you actually have to make a profit. And the poor souls that come in as those second or third CEOs that have to create an economic model out of this is just, and so tied to that, my happy yelling is twofold. One is, have you noticed?
I just think the gobbledygook rant is rich coming from someone who grew up in a country where you take a lift to pip over to Gigglesbury for a spot of bangers. So gobbledygook away. Okay.
That means continue. I'm going to the village pub for a good piece of sausage. Makes perfect sense. So in the good news, I don't know why I thought about this, but isn't it great that nobody gives two shits about Facebook anymore?
It's great. Yeah.
Nobody cares, which I think is great. But on that note, Instagram, their subsidiary, just is about to die, right? Do you get anything but ads?
No.
Because that is the profitable business model, right? Because all of this is funded by investor money to buy market share, and then you have to make a profit, and the ratio of ads to actually interesting content to make the returns that you have to both make a profit and pay off all of that investment.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so disproportionate.
I think the under-discussed is Pinterest, which has gotten significantly worse, and they don't distinguish between ads and content very well.
Because you have to, because it's, some grown-up is in the back. And look, LinkedIn is on a similar journey. Like, you can feel it happening. Anyway, but I'm going to finish with good yelling at clouds. Well, I'm going to yell at my friend Ange, in London, to say, how has she not put me onto this? But it is the Yorkshire burrito. Yorkshire burrito is...
I've seen it on the internet.
Have you seen it?
It wasn't an ad.
It is. So it's a Yorkshire pudding, mm-hmm. and you put a Sunday dinner. So a Yorkshire Sunday dinner is roast beef, gravy, mashed potatoes, and a few veg. And this, so it was like pancake batter that you make it. Yep. Except you roll it all up into a burrito. Google it. It's the best. How have I not come across this? It's time to go home and have a Yorkshire burrito. All right, yelling over with.
I love it. Well, hey, let's wrap this thing up. Where are you heading next?
I'm here.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, I'm here too. That's great. So come visit us. But as we've been yelling and ranting at various things, can I just leave you with the bumper sticker from the parking lot of the coffee shop that I just left? It was very discreetly, just black and white. On the back of a very regular car, and it simply says, this is just a reminder to lighten the fuck up.
I love it.
I'm Scott Wayne.
Lighten the fuck up. We'll see you next time.